This is all, I don't know if any of what I'm about to tell you is actually what happened or if it's how I remember it, but the class was taught by the town budget, the guy that was in charge of finances for the town where my college was. And he would come into class. The class was called public budgeting. And for some reason I signed up for it, not thinking it would be boring. It was incredibly boring. He would rush into class 12 minutes late with a stack of folders, I'm not kidding you, the size of like a milk crate under his arm, completely overworked at his day job as the town budget guy. And then he would come in for anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour to regale us in minute detail all of the day-to-day comings and goings of the public budgeting office. When I say I learned nothing in the class, I think I'm being incredibly generous. He just talked about the mayor, the mayor's wife, you know, how the mayor used his office to advance his own political career, how if you really cared about municipalities, you should never get into city government, this kind of thing, which as a young starry-eyed political science student was dispiriting, to say the least. So that's the story of the worst class I took as an undergrad.
Thank you. I'm here today with Hal Williams, a political scientist in the Department of Political, what is it, Political Science?
Anthropology, sociology. Yes.
And today we're talking about bad courses, both bad courses we've experienced as students and bad courses we've experienced as teachers. This is your tipple for the week, and it's a production of the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching, CELT. And I'm Leslie Lindenauer, the director of CELT. So welcome, Howell.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Me too.
So I have a question. I mean, I should say that the idea for this particular podcast came from a workshop that I did at the last year's NearComp annual conference, or the 2023 NearComp conference, where we were invited in and we spent an hour and a half developing a bad course and then flipping it, learning from what made a bad course and making it a good course at the end. Today we're going to focus on bad courses, and we'll flip it, sometime in the next couple of weeks. And so I thank you to the people who presented the workshop at NearComp, and it's a technique that's been used at other universities to help us think critically about the way we teach. When that professor came in and talked at you, was there a chance to ask questions, or were you just consuming what he said?
It's going to take me a little while to even cast my mind back to this incredibly traumatic experience as a student. I remember having such little interest in the subject matter that if I had questions to ask, I don't know if I would have even bothered. But I don't remember him generally being a very curious professor. Generally, I don't remember him taking much interest in us as students or what we brought to the class or how we understood the material that we were absorbing. So I don't have an exact recollection, which tells me he probably didn't.
Yeah, I that's really interesting, because I think that one of the principles that if we were really unpacking the distinction between bad teaching and good teaching, one of the principles we talk about is motivation, what motivates students. We talk about learning theory and how we apply learning theory in our classrooms, both as students and as teachers. And so I think that what you've just described is a great example of failure to connect.
I think that's right. I think I really, as an instructor now, a lot of the direction that my classes take is guided by student interests. And I don't know if it was the experience in that class specifically or just in my evolution as an instructor, but I've grown to appreciate how important it is to engage with what students are thinking in the moment as the class is unfolding.
Yeah, my greatest failure as a faculty member was at the very beginning, my first course taught here at Western, and I didn't engage at all with the students. I was so pleased to be teaching an early American history course. It was my field. I had been working in, you know, the museum field for a number of years, but I was the professor now, and I just went in there and expounded. And the first day, I had a non-traditional student in the class who stood outside the room, and every time a student passed him leaving the classroom, he said, "She's awful, isn't she?"
Wow.
Yeah. And I heard him say that, and I thought, I might as well leave now. There's no way I can improve enough to stop that from happening again.
Wow. I was going to ask you how you knew it didn't go well, but that's a pretty clear example. I'm really sorry to hear it. I mean, it is, we should say, especially being a first-time instructor at a new institution, it's always, you do have that sense of like, I want to just share what I have. But yeah, that must not have been.
It was a wake up call.
Sure.
And I think, here's one of the problems. And I know we often talk about this as faculty members when we talk about improving our teaching, but as doctoral candidates, as, people pursuing the terminal degree in our fields, no one talks about teaching.
Completely.
We are never given a chance except to lecture to first year classes.
Right? Exactly.
That's the modality, right? We're stuck in front of a class and we lecture because that's what the professors do.
While you're also studying for comps, while you're also becoming this expert in your field. So it is easy to think, oh, what I'm doing in this area must be what I should be doing in this area. You're right. I mean, the instruction on teaching and learning at the graduate level is, at least in my experience, was almost non-existent.
Yeah, but I never even stopped to think about why that might be important. I mean, none of us, I wasn't even sure I wanted to be a professor as I pursued my PhD. I didn't think about what the distinction between an R1 and a teaching university might be, but most of us end up in teaching universities.
Sure.
The vast majority of people who get jobs at all, and, every day I get up and I say, thank God I have a job doing something that I love, the vast majority of us are at teaching universities.
Right.
And I came through the university system where it was most usual for faculty members to be what is sort of globally called the sage on the stage. Literally, one of my worst class experiences was an 8 a.m. Okay, oof. This is about structure, right?
Sure.
This is about learning theory and about learning design. 8 a.m., a Shakespeare class where we went in and the professor read from Shakespeare. That's all
wow.
he did. He didn't even talk about Shakespeare. He just opened up the annotated volume of Shakespeare's plays and read.
Wow. I mean, that story kind of reminds me of the origins of the American Academy, which are in training pastors and preachers, right? So there, there's a direct lineage between people just standing in front and reading from a book. You talk about teaching design. My worst class that I taught here at Western, it's been a few years now, so I feel more comfortable telling this story now. It was a once a week evening class. And I was used to teaching my twice a week sort of afternoon classes, having my activities, my lectures, that kind of thing. And I hadn't really blocked out the planning for a class that would take place over 2.5 hours. And it was a slog for the students, I know, because I was still in that same kind of sage on the stage mentality. I thought, I'm going to have to fill 2.5 hours with lecture. And it was only after about two-thirds of the way through the semester that I realized that I needed to shake it up, that I had to find new ways to engage students across that 2.5 hours doing different activities, not just to ensure that they were getting the most out of the class, but to make sure that I was also, that I remained engaged across that time as well.
Yeah, and it's a process, right? No one tells you that it's going to be a process. No one tells you that, you know, there are things that you can try to help you improve at, in the classroom, because no one, very few people tell graduate students how important that will be.
Definitely. Yes. I think that was in my first year here. Yeah, exactly. It was fresh out of that graduate training. And you really do, the process of learning how to teach really is a career-long process.
Yeah, and I think that that part of that is being willing to take risks, because, you know, and along with those risks come failures in the classroom too, right? But or ceding control, and this is one of the hardest things we all have to learn, or we don't learn, and, you know, and I think that students lose out, but the ability to cede control to our students, and you open with that, you know, this idea that students should, in at least in part, guide us in what we share with them. If you don't, if you're not willing to do that, you've already put up a barrier.
Absolutely. I've, the ceding control thing is so important. I learned that in my engagement as an undergrad. I learned the most and the best when I was really empowered to take over my own learning. But also as an instructor, you have, and my students will attest to this, I love to like map out every session, you know. So when students start the class in the last week of August, you know, they know exactly where they will be in the middle of November. But the problem with that is I teach political science. You know what I mean? There's never a semester that goes by that some rupture in the outside world doesn't cause us to have to pause and kind of, and I hope I've gotten better at that, but it is a learning process, because you want to, you're like, no, we have to get to this point. But I'm slowly learning that, the end point is where you end up, regardless of, you know, the path that you take to get there.
No, that's an excellent point. I mean, when I think about it, I can't imagine teaching political science in this culture and atmosphere, but the ability to pivot, to respond to the world around us, even, you know, I'm an early American historian, and I still feel that it's my obligation to be able to do that. If I'm not allowing students to make links between the past and the present, then I'm failing in some fashion. I'm failing them, and I'm failing myself. But it's hard.
It is hard. It's very hard.
Yeah, and we I came in, I guess, after graduate school. I come in thinking exactly what you've just said, that there's a certain amount of material I have to cover.
Sure.
If I don't make it through, you know, the Civil War, and if I haven't prepared students to take the Praxis exam in American
yes.
history, then I'm failing them. And so I have to cover everything from the pre-contact period through the American Civil War and Reconstruction. And then I realize that's impossible. And I can, not all content is going to be important.
It's so true. And I also want to say, I don't know if this was the budgeting class or another experience as an undergrad, but some of my worst experiences in undergrad were when the beginning of the semester, the first assigned reading is chapter one from the textbook. And every week you just read a textbook chapter, and that's the content that you're presented with. There's never application, you know, there's never outside material. You never get the chance to talk about your the units, you know, in context. I think that has been something that I've really strived to do, especially in my intro classes. I do kind of follow a basic format, but I think the artifice that our respective disciplines, and whatever discipline this is, sort of imposes on instructors is the result of textbook companies and, you know, there's a lot of sort of external pressures that make us feel like there is a kind of cookie cutter way to teach a class, like Intro to American History or Intro to American Government, or, you know, there are these sort of right and wrong ways to approach this material. And I think it's really hard to shake that off. It's also a lot of work. You know, it requires you to kind of think creatively about what is really important to me as an instructor, and what do I have subject knowledge in that would benefit my students in ways that they wouldn't get in another context. Like, for example, in my American Government class, I do a unit on American political culture, which is not necessarily a kind of common component of a class like that. But I think it's really important because it's how I understand the rest of the semester. And so it's easier for me to communicate those subjects that I do think students need to have a background in if I start from a place that is really, you know, the way that I understand the material.
Oh, I love that point. I hadn't thought about this, but I do the same thing because my starting point now, after years, is always memory and history, right? My starting point is always the way we remember the past. And so, and in some ways, that's sort of American historical culture. Right. And the way we remember the past shapes the way I teach about the past, too. And that allows students to make those links between past and present. And it's had a dramatic impact on the way I choose subject matter that I want to teach.
Yeah, same for me. Yeah. And I don't know if that's the result of having bad classes necessarily, but I do know that those experiences where it just felt rote were not memorable. And I want to provide students with a memorable experience in the classroom.
Yeah, I want students to remember. I also want students to feel comfortable.
Yes.
Or uncomfortable, sure, depending sure. upon the moment or the material.
Sure.
I mean, one of the worst classes I had as a high school student, I was in AP English, and we were asked to write an autobiography. And I wrote this autobiography, and I vivid memories of this. I entitled it "A Piece of Me on Paper," oh. and I got a C minus on it.
Oh,
and
I thought, gosh! Oh, gosh!
I can't even. I'm not even average on paper.
Right. I can't even talk about myself in an average way.
And I think that made me acutely aware of asking students to make themselves vulnerable in a classroom,
sure, absolutely,
and then honoring that vulnerability. I have asked students to write autobiographies in class before in a historic context, and I cannot imagine. In fact, I can't imagine grading them at all,
right?
Unless you know a student doesn't do the work. So that to me has also helped shaped the way I think about assessment in the classroom.
Oh yeah,
too.
Absolutely. I think that point about vulnerability is it really, for me at least, cuts both ways as well. I appreciate students that are willing to break themselves out of their comfort zones, but I also am very honest with my own stakes in what we do in the classroom. I think that, and again, I think this might be a factor in the subject area that I teach, but my students hear me say this all the time, we're not studying things, you know, in a vacuum. We are living through a political moment. And I think being honest with students about that and about your own stakes is also really an important way to connect and sort of help students get the most out of their experience in the class.
Yeah, I agree. That moment of connection that comes from, I mean, we've always been taught that we shouldn't share too much about who we are. And I don't know that I've ever totally agreed with that. I understand that there is a power relationship between a faculty member and students, but I also can't hide my approach to my subject matter. And for me, those moments are, you know, they're furiously coming at us right now as a historian when, you know, the discipline in which I teach is being threatened in, you know, more than a dozen states, literally threatened, where the history that I teach is being erased from curricula and where, you know, entire DEI staff are being dismissed at universities. You know, I have to be able to talk about how important I think that is.
Yeah, I agree. I shied away from that when I first started being, you know, when I first started as an instructor. And I have, because I was worried about my students' responses. And, you know, our students are, one thing I love about teaching at the college level is our students are adults. You know, we're all adults in the room. And I think trusting your students and giving your students a lot, not a lot of reading or a lot of homework, but like a lot of big things to think about, students, I think, thrive in those environments. I've never, I can't think of off the top of my head a moment where I've thought after a class, I put too much on the table. I put too much on my students' plates. You know, I'm always so impressed with students' ability to think through really complex themes and concepts. I always say I'm learning with my students. You know, we're all working on this material together. And yeah, I think that's a really valuable way to, for me at least, to get the most out of the classroom.
Oh, I think that's a great place to end. We're going to revisit this. We did a lot of the work that I anticipated we'd end up doing by flipping.
We'll have more. Don't worry.
We always have stuff to say.
We do.
And so we will revisit that. So in the coming weeks, you will hear podcasts that flip the situations that Hal Williams and I have been talking about today. And we'll focus on some of the strategies in the classroom that help us connect with students. We'll be talking about the importance of local and community history in the classroom, particularly in a place like Danbury, Connecticut, where we have an incredibly diverse city and an incredibly diverse student body. And so all of that is coming up. And as always, if you have ideas about where we should take the podcast and subjects and topics that you'd like us to discuss, please feel free to contact me. I'm Leslie Lindenauer, Director of the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching. Thanks.
Tipple is a production of WCSU Media, engineered by Peter Puccio and produced by Scott Folby. Listen and subscribe on Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at WCSU Podcasts and on the university's Facebook and Twitter pages. And feel free to reach out to us by email at podcasts@wcsu.edu. Thanks for listening.